Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatec.
No, you're working at Inatec because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Holly, Andrew on the board. We have S&P futures. Let's see. Dutch halts state intervention at Chinese owned chipmaker Nexperia. I don't even know what any of these places are. We'll have to ask Kevin who all these people are. He's a chipmaker kind of guy. Larry Summers resigns from OpenAI board after release of emails with Epstein. S&P futures up 22, NASDAQ futures up 106. We're trying to bounce back from 4 days in the crapo, so we'll see if we do that today. Big news tonight is NVIDIA's earnings, and they seem to be leading the market, so we'll see what story their chairman comes out with. He always manages to come out with a good one, so no reason to think he won't this time, I guess. Do we have Professor Kevin?
He comes out with a good one, huh?
Well,
it may be BS, but at least it's high quality BS.
I don't know what about that guy rubs me the wrong way so much, Kevin. I don't know. I get the feeling he's like the Harold Janine of our generation. He works from country to country and really doesn't care about any of them. And you know, which I suppose if you were in that spot, maybe you'd feel the same way. But it doesn't feel so good to me. Just doesn't. I'm not one of those guys.
I look at that is on two levels. Is one, of course, if you're going to run an international business, then there is a certain amount of that. But I think you also there's ethical lines to be drawn, and I do think that that's probably something that is left out of the equation, and it shouldn't be. And I'll give you an example. Coca-Cola was one, I'm trying to think, Procter & Gamble was one, that were official sponsors of the Beijing Olympics. You know what? I know you want to do business in China. I know you want to sell, and that could be a really tricky proposition, sometimes dealing with the CCP. So I totally get all of that. But do you need to pile on by being official sponsor of their showcase event where they're trying to show off their way of life and do that? And my answer to that would be no. I would draw that line and say no, I'm not doing that. But Coca-Cola obviously doesn't feel that same way, which is why I happen to be sipping on a Pepsi right now.
Well, when it comes down to it, I mean, this is going to sound somewhat harsh. Why should these guys give a crap about your and my line? Everybody's going to make their own line, and more money that's involved, seeming like the line keeps moving, doesn't it?
Yeah, but they should have some line. Whether it's their line, whether it's my line or your line, I don't know. I just think you got to draw the line somewhere. And, okay, so I don't have to patronize them. Cool, I'm good.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't think many people feel that way because there's a whole lot of Coke. You know, and when you think of Coca-Cola, there's so many Coca-Cola products. You know, their lines of business are, it's incredibly diverse. Things like Honest Tea is one of their products. So, you know, it's not always clear. And if you really want to do a personal boycott, you got to go out of your way. Now, I challenge you, try and avoid Procter & Gamble stuff. I mean, they're everywhere.
Which again is if there is a theme to this show, Kevin, if there is one, if I can find one, I think the honest theme is everything depends on everybody else. if you're worried about people like Coke or NVIDIA or other people maybe not having the line where you might want it, if you, you know, if you say you're the government, who knows where their line is, you don't let them buy every other damn company. Duh.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems to be like, what do you mean? We love mergers. Well, Wall Street loves mergers. Okay.
And that on its own can be its own can of worms, let alone, you know, how it lines up with some of the ethical issues behind it.
It's another, but just when you think there's no reason whatsoever to think you're lucky in this world. Yesterday, I'm leaving work, minding my own business, get in the elevator, and all of a sudden the door opens, and a lady walks on with a German Shepherd, and I look, beautiful Shepherd, and I notice the dark glasses, and the dog, she gives me a sniff, and gives me a look, and figures, okay, this guy's okay, whatever, so I pass muster with the pooch, and so we start talking, and I said, well, boy, it's a beautiful dog, and she goes, well, thank you, and I've had her like 3 or 4 years now, and lady couldn't have been happier with life. And I go, God, she seems like she's pretty good. She goes, she gets me across Wacker Drive back and forth every day to the train. I'm going, this lady's taking the train downtown across Wacker Drive with this dog, and she's the happiest person I ever met, Kevin. I'm sitting there going, whatever problems you think you have, you should just like get rid of them or forget about them. It's like, what the hell? So there's a good part of the humanity as well. You know, it just...
Yeah, there is. And a lot of that is, you know, it gets to be people's nature, too. So, you know, from my standpoint, you know, I know I am this. I am an optimist. So, as you know, probably in way more detail, it's come up a couple of times, so our listeners might have a hint of it. But, you know, from May until now.
Yeah.
You know, I've been sick off and on, you know, different things, nothing. I've been able to function, you know, all summer long. I couldn't go into the office, so I still taught my classes, but I taught them via Zoom, and I would tell my students every day, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it all the way through this class, but I'll give you what I got for as long as I got, and we'll do that. But I have never doubted for a minute that sooner or later we're going to figure out everything that's going on with me and get it resolved. And that's just, you know, that's my nature. So there's a lot of people who don't have that outlook. You know, you sort of figure the worst case scenario is the one that's most likely to happen, and you're surprised by the best case. I tend to be the other way around. I'm always thinking, and that's, you know, that's personal. It's how I was raised. It's, you know, there's a lot of things. There's things that have come up in life that challenge you, and when you get past them, and frankly, you know, how I made a living for a long time, you know, just, you know, taking over very dysfunctional departments and turning them around, you know, you start to believe that it's always going to work out, you know. So you know, that I think that outlook matters a lot, and I forget how we got on to that, but
well, we're talking about the lady with the, you know, coming.
The lady she's one of those people. Her locus of control is that she is, you know, she's in control of her life. She happens to life. Life doesn't happen to her. And I get that outlook, and I really, you know, especially when you have somebody that has her challenges, I really have a lot of respect for that.
And the idea that the pooch was helping her out was pretty cool. And anyway, plus the pooch seemed to like me, which is even nicer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know what the hell's wrong with that dog.
Or it didn't smell like a pork chop or something. One or the other. Hey,
we got to use that as an insult sometime. Oh, you smell like a pork chop.
even what was the insult on the trading floor? Put two pork chops in your pocket, and the dog still doesn't like you, or something. There were all kinds of great lines in the trading floor. I don't know if they're ready for regular use, but anyway. Hey, what did you? I don't know if you were able to zero in yesterday on the discussion with Hal. What'd you make of all that? For a quick review, Hal has been doing a lot of work on. He's teaching two new classes, and the man researches stuff like there's no tomorrow. And you came across an article from a guy, having to do with banking. And we've talked from time to time with bits and pieces as, you know, as they've come up on the show for years regarding, you know, certainly what I consider to be one of the issues with the middle class going where every politician seems to think they're pushing them, which is total BS in my mind, but is that the gap between financing if you've got money versus if you don't. When I say if you don't, if you're a smaller company, if you're a plumbing company, electric company, if you're looking to get a bigger job that all of a sudden you need financing because you're not getting paid for 6 months or something, that gap has gotten, in my mind, tremendously wide. Maybe not as bad in Illinois, because there are still a lot of smaller banks that may want to listen to you, and probably do. And I think in your area, Kevin, there's probably some smaller banks that do that too, but I think in some areas of the country, it's not at all. But then, plus there's the Dodd-Frank part, which I've never read from stem to stern, but, you know, in there is a lot of stuff at some level. They want personal guarantees, and you got to pony up your house, even though it's a corporation and you've never missed a payment, and this kind of crap that causes family issues, other issues. I mean, it's a whole different. When was the last time, you know, Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos had to give a personal guarantee on a loan? Well, anyway, Hal dug up a whole bunch of other stuff regarding banks. We don't have traditional reserve requirements anymore, but we have capital requirements on banks, and it appears that the capital requirement on, like, 10 loans to plumbing companies that have always paid their bills are much higher than they are in one big loan to some either rich guy or big company. And I sort of have sensed that for a while, but I never actually saw it on paper. But anyway, Hal and I were digging through it yesterday. I just wanted your comments on that, Kevin. I know that banks, even my bank, Lakeside, even though PTI uses BMO Harris, but did they officially drop the Harris? I think they did, but anyway, they were BMO Harris. I had talked to Fannie, and she goes, yeah, well, if you want an auto loan, we'll give you one tomorrow. But we don't have an auto loan department anymore. You know, we don't have, like, a small business department anymore. I mean, maybe they do in some of their branches, but they don't do that. It's bigger loans, and it's, you know, I think Treasury stuff. And, you know, how are we ever going to get the middle class, as every president for the last 10 has touted that they're after? They do one thing and do another. To me, the banking system is one of the biggest issues with the middle class and lower class and small businesses. Am I wrong here or no?
No, I don't think you are. And I know a lot of the, we don't, it's not necessarily that we have a lot of small banks in the area. We have a lot of regional banks, you know, just so they're not teeny. If you look at a First Source or a Centere, I mean, they've got a pretty big footprint in Indiana into Michigan, and so on, and so they aren't trivial. It's not your neighborhood bank or your old neighborhood SNL.
So they're not like the little ones downtown here in Stone, Illinois.
They'd be like Wintrust, but probably all Wintrust if you're backed up 15 years.
But you don't have a Lakeside, you don't have a Burling, you don't have you know, the little neighborhood ones. They still have
Marquette yeah. National, you know, the banks like that. So, you know, it's not, but they're not too different. They still have the, you know, the community touch and the community feel to them. So they have that. But the other people that are making a lot of personal loans, and that includes car loans, because they'll lend through dealers, is of the local credit unions. And we have quite a few credit unions in the area. You know, I have a credit union account, and gosh, I can, you know, rattle off three or four off the top of my head that are local credit unions, and I think those are filling that gap in a lot of places.
I think they are here too in a lot of ways. But, you know, some of the stuff.
And then there's some mega credit unions too. United Federal's in our area, and I mean, heck, they're all over the place. They have not a full national reach, but I know they're into places like Texas. So, you know, the market is it's sort of shaking out in a way that that I guess is defying the consolidation of the recent past.
Well, when they get too big, how are the big banks going to snuff them out like they snuffed everybody else out?
That's a good question as to where that will ultimately go, and I don't know the answer to that.
Because you still have to join. I'm a member of the Credit Union One, I think it is. And I actually have a Visa card from them, and I don't think I've ever used it, but Kevin, I think it's like 8% or something along those lines, 10%. Which might bring the question, why don't I use it? Well, I don't carry a balance, but if I did, I mean, but those, I think what it used to be, you actually had a B, if it was St. John Fisher Credit Union, if my stepfather used to run for a while with another guy, you had a B in the parish. Well, I don't think they checked your address, but I think I had to pay $5 to join Credit Union One. I mean, you have to, and it is a, somehow or other, it's still a membership thing, right?
Yeah, it is, and the membership requirements tend to be pretty loose, so, geographic area will work for a lot of them, so if you live in the area, you're pretty good. You're not going to worry about it.
I haven't talked to him in ages, but he always wanted to get up some money and buy a Southside Bank, kind of in the hood, just so the area wasn't, bereft of banking. And he also was looking at credit unions, and I did a lot of research on them. They're still around, Kevin, and you can go buy one. Hell, it was some Southside parish that still had a credit union, and they had like a couple of $1,000 was all that was in there, and like two people left. But you can go buy one.
So you buy the credit union charter, and then you build up the business.
Yeah, I mean you can do. I mean I won't say it's easy to do. I don't know how the hell you do it, but I mean I can't imagine it's that difficult.
Well, the members would have to approve the sale.
Yeah.
So you have to get both of them.
Yeah, I just but this whole this whole banking thing. On the one hand, you're gonna help out the middle class, and in the next minute, you're gonna tell banks. You're going to give them the okay to get somebody's, the deed on their house crossing over. Because, at a certain level, Kevin, the idea of a corporation being separating the risk from your personal stuff doesn't even exist. And that's by law. I mean, it's not by the bank choosing that. And that, to be perfectly blunt, sucks. I mean, they just... whatever it is, the big banks, but some of the stuff we talk about, antitrust. I mean, look at, when you have, they haven't done it in a while, but say General Motors, Ford, whoever it is, free financing for 4 years, or some bullcrap like that. Well, it's not bullcrap if it's you. But now, what does that mean exactly? And I hope that our listeners, you would hope that your students from your economic places, you should immediately cause a problem in your brain. You say, okay, wait a minute. What are we doing here? It's called what? It's vertical. You're favoring one place for another, and you own both of them, right? You're not supposed to do that. Clayton Act absolutely forbids that. So work it through. What's actually happening here? If I go buy the car, and places used to do this. I mean, way back. If you go buy your Chevy, man, and the car is $40,000, and you're going to get free financing for 4 years. Well, that's worth something, right? Because why would anybody, if they're going rate 6 and they're giving you 0, it's worth something on 40G. Now maybe they're making you put $5,000 down, whatever the details are. Well, there's a say it's $4,000 or $3,000 or some number. I guess figure it out. But say it's $3,000. It ought to be, first of all, it ought to be free financing for 4 years or $3,000 off. At the very least, if you go to another institution, if I went to Lakeside Bank and said, these guys are going to give me $3,000 towards the financing of a $40,000 car for 4 years, they may say, give us the $3,000. We'll give you 500 back. It still could be competitive, right, Kevin? But they're using it as a way to shut out Lakeside Bank. That's why you don't see car loan departments in banks anymore, because essentially the GMAC and those other people, or whoever it is they're feeding it to, have taken that over, and they've done it by monopoly strategy.
And the way they finance it, of course, it's really just a pricing strategy, not anything else. So, to them, it's just it's just a payment method for how you buy the car. No different than the old days when you used to be able to put things on layaway or do a Christmas plan or something like that. It's just another way of doing that. And it's you know, but you're right. They're probably technically legal on antitrust, but you know, is it tying agreements? If
you could buy a car for $40,000 and you're going to get free financing for 4 years, somebody is getting $3,000 or $4,000 because that's what that's worth, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if they say the only somebody is GMAC and not you or Lakeside, that's a problem.
Yeah, and what I'm saying is they might as well just charge you less for the car because that's essentially what they're doing.
Well, that's right. And for some reason, they used to do that. I mean, way back in the 70s and so forth, they would say, you know, free financing for 3 years or $2,500 off or something. I haven't seen that in ages, have you?
No, actually, I haven't, now that you mention it.
Anyway, we talked a little bit last night, but neither one of us really give a crap about Kelly's deal. But one of my guys, of course, was railing me last night regarding the, what was it, 8 years he's owed $8 million or something, Kevin? Let's say 8 years at $8 million. I don't think it was quite that much. It was 7 years.
Actually, I think it was getting more like $10 million a year. So
it was $80 million or something, wasn't it? Well,
right, it was a lot of money. It was a lot of money.
Right, don't say 10 because I just did all these numbers based on 8. So let's say it's 8. So they essentially, there was a settlement that I thought was out there. That in the settlement, what I thought was, because our friend Kevin, who we're talking to, said that the contract with the gentleman at Penn State was written different than the Charlie Weiss contract. And this has nothing.
Just to throw on an aside on there, Virginia Tech just hired the Penn State coach, James
right.
Frank.
So the Charlie Weiss deal at Notre Dame was,
Penn State won't owe him as much.
Yeah, so the Charlie Weiss deal was, when you fired him, you just owed him his salary for the next 5 years, chop chop. I mean, that was it.
Well, for however long it was, they paid him for a long time. He was one of their highest paid employees for a really long time.
Well, he had just signed an extension, didn't he, the year before or something?
They freaked out. His first year he came in and they were very successful. Darner beat Southern Cal, but for the illegal push back in those days, helping the runner was illegal. They were afraid now that the pro teams were all going to come looking for Charlie Weiss because his background was all NFL before he came to Notre Dame. And the athletic director at the time just freaked out and, you know, did a preemptive strike to sign him up for a long time. And boy, was that premature.
Yeah. Well, anyway, in this day and age, and just trying to get people used to it, I'm not predicting we're going back to higher interest rates. I see the danger of it, but I'm not predicting it. But just so you know, I just want to run these interest rates by people once in a while. But now, this is something very simple. The guy from Penn State had, Kevin, if he got another job, then the other job subtracted from what they owed him, and there was a bunch of caveats in there. Well, evidently, Kelly's is not the same way, which is pretty crazy. I'm going to stick with my number, $8 million. $8 million a year. Okay, so 8 years out, they came up like a month ago and said, okay, he's settling for $30 million instead of the, whatever, 50 or something. Now, if any of you have ever won the lotto, which I haven't.
It's 64, but go ahead.
Yeah, whatever it is, there's always going to be, if you want your money today, it's going to be less of a number. Because if you go to the lotto and you win $1 billion, you may think you won $1 billion, but you didn't. You're winning, what, $50 million a year for 20 years, right? Or something like that. So if you say, give me my money today, what should pop into everybody's head after listening to me for all this time? The first question should be, okay, what's the discount rate? What interest rate are we dragging this back at? And I hope that people who listen to the show, it immediately pops in their head. I know the general population, it doesn't, because we really haven't had much of an interest rate for a long time. But let's just take Kelly's fictional number here. 8 years out, you owe the guy $8 million. All right. So if you were to take a 6% rate, which is roughly a mortgage, and want to pay him today, that's $5 million. Because compounded at 6%, that would be $8 million in 8 years. If, however, Kelly says, wait a minute, you that's not a risk-free rate. If you're going to put it in T-bills or something, or in a treasury, or what, or look at the rates have been over the last 10 years, you're only going to make 3%. If you can talk him into that, the number is 6.3. However, if LSU says, hey, bleeps, market's done nothing but go straight up the last 10 years. We've made an average of 12% a year on our endowment, which they may have. Now, the last 4 days they haven't, but they may have. And if you say we're going to make 12% on that money. So now if they can talk Kelly into taking a 12% number, that's only $3 million. Yeah, and so it's 5, it's 6, it's 6.3 at 12, and it's 3.2 at 3, I mean at 12. And it's a big difference, right?
Yes.
And now, Mike, what rate would you, if you were Kelly, what rate would you accept? What are you supposed to state uses? And for the lottery, I wouldn't know because I never won it.
Yeah, you know, I would want, if I were LSU, I'd want them to take it, you know, at a real conservative investment rate, like, you know, long-term treasury bills or something.
No,
like
you wouldn't.
That.
You'd say we're making 12%. You want the highest rate going for him. He wants the lowest.
Yeah, so he wants the low rate. Yeah. Okay.
Their lawyer's going to say,
I'm going over that, and we've now given it more airtime than it deserves.
Well, but you know what? But it will come back to haunt everybody and everything you do, because it used to, didn't it? When the rates were 12%, if somebody said, Kevin, I'm going to give you $1 million in 20 years, you almost say, forget it.
Well, yeah, and actually for people who are proposing, you know, spends at their business and they have to run things by their CFO, you know, it, for a long time, everybody was fine just by laying out the income, the cumulative, and then the cash flow and cumulative cash flow. And we didn't have to put a discount rate on it because the cost of funds was so low it didn't matter. It matters a little bit more now, and you are seeing that in business. I'm getting that from my people who are in industry, and so now hurdle rates are back as part of the discussion about funding projects.
We've had some discussions that we were talking about veterans and everything else the last week or two. We also have had some kind of discussions, Kevin, and you were involved in them. And what would happen, I mean, given the fact, whatever side you're on, I think getting things done in Washington in terms of any kind of bills of any consequence has really been a disaster for a long time. What if, if 15... people are listening to us this morning and they go, wow, these two idiots are right. These banking bills really are kind of taking people the wrong way in terms of financing smaller business. I mean, what do you think the timing would be even if 15 people on each side of the aisle said, we got to redo this Dodd-Frank. We got to go back and figure out what the hell we're doing here. Maybe instead of a capital requirement on the banks, we should go back to a reserve requirement. There shouldn't be an advantage in terms of capital to lending to rich people and big companies versus other people. How long, Kevin, and is it even possible for some of that to get changed? I don't see it, do you?
Well, yeah, I'm thinking about that. No, it's a powerful industry lobby, so if they like the status quo, it ain't going to change.
Do you think they do?
I don't know. Yeah, as you say it, I'm thinking about it. There's probably, let me put it this way. There are probably a lot of older people, you know, and that would be people our age, maybe a little bit younger, who sort of yearn for the old days. And then you get a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of people invested in like the Dodd-Frank model, which in many ways shackles banks. It imposes some requirements, some safety nets, but you know, obviously it didn't help. What did we have last year? You know, we had a little little rash of regional bank closings and takeovers. So, as an industry, it's been pretty stable for a while. And, you know, it just in general, especially compared to where it was, you know, if you were to back with, certainly compared to where it was early in this century, and in many ways with the numbers of acquisitions, because when I was in the business into the 80s, 90s, and into the 2000s, acquisition mania was like crazy. I got sold three times, on about a 5-year schedule. You know, every 5 years, I would be senior management in a bank, and the bank got sold, and of course I was on to the next place. But I also went through five acquisitions in that same time frame. So 8 total, 5 as the buyer and 3 as the seller. So, you know, that was the industry at the time, and it was, I think in many ways, even though the industry was attempting to consolidate, it was disruptive because there was just so much of that merger activity going on. And it isn't so much the merger impact on lending as it is on operations, IT systems, et cetera. And that's where it was really disrupting things. And I think that has calmed down to a large degree, has probably made a lot of people in that industry happy.
Well, you also, there's not as many people to pick up. They're already picked up.
Well, that's true. I mean, sooner or later, everybody's been bought. The question is, how many times has everybody been bought? So if you remember, I started out my career at American National Bank in downtown Chicago, which got bought by First Chicago, which got bought by NBD, which got bought by Chase.
And now it's JPMorgan Chase.
Yeah, I think it was JPM Chase. American National is the fifth largest bank in Chicago. You know, is there anybody headquartered in Chicago anymore?
Northern Trust. Probably the only one.
Yeah. But isn't Northern Trust, what's their affiliation? Do they have a Canadian bank affiliation?
No, that's BMO Harris.
Yeah, that's right. That was Harris. Okay.
But Northern Trust is a much more of a trust and investment kind of place than a bank.
Yeah, it always had a different character than all the others.
But I remember when I was a Ute, First National Bank, Evergreen Park had a beautiful building. It was the heart and soul of that community. There were a couple of savings and loans for did houses. Yeah, but I had a checking account there at a minute. And people got a checking account when I got my first car loan there. I bought a Fiat for my parents. My loan was like $2,000. They had no problem with that. I paid it off. And I did something else. And then all of a sudden, when I was in the remodeling business, I went in and I said, you know, we just bought this place, and I showed them the paperwork. Robin and I did, the late Robin. I said, we're going to, you know, fix it up. And by the way, we're going to sell it. And they lent me $10,000. You know, this is in 1977. I paid that back, and I might have got my first Visa card through them too, when banks were doing it on their own. And all of a sudden, one day, they get bought by Old Kent, and these guys had a gorgeous building, a big drive-through, massive vault downstairs. I mean, everybody's safety deposit box was there too, so they probably made money on that as well. They get bought by Old Kent. Ozinga was the Ozinga, the concrete people. They were the big money behind it. And the second biggest dude was the guy who owned Bleeker's Bowling Alley, where we'd pile in after basketball and drink beers and eat hot dogs. They were the last place I knew, Kevin, that had the bar chicken on the bar. How many people even know what bar chicken is?
I didn't even know what bar chicken is. What's bar chicken?
Hard-boiled egg.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, so the guy from Bleeker's, the place gets taken over. All of a sudden, the guy's a millionaire. He has a grabber and dies the next day. So Old Kent couldn't have been there a year before they get bought by Fifth Third. And so now Fifth Third owns the place. They decide, screw it. They tear the whole building down. what they did with that vault underground, what it must have cost them to destroy that vault or move it. Now it's a car dealership. I'm like, what the? There's progress, huh, Kevin?
Well, at least you can go to that building and get a car loan.
Or maybe they still got the vault downstairs. I mean,
I bet they do.
I mean, how do you move one of those things? The door on the thing had to be a foot and a half thick.
I would have been hard to get out of there. I definitely would. Would have done that.
I don't know who the hell they had was strong enough to swing the door open and shut. It must have been some kind of a counterweight. But anyway, you know, you look at all this and you just wonder, because what brought this up is just the timing of it. Is one of my friends went to a fundraiser for this lady running for Senate in Michigan. So, of course, I call Kevin and say, who the hell is the lady? She's in Michigan. And it turns out she's 39 years old. She's a Domer. Very attractive lady, red hair. Apparently, she's got an engineering degree. My friend Bill was very impressive. She speaks very well. She seems to have a lot of ideas. She's got nothing but energy, and which you would have to do that. So I call Kevin up, and we start talking about she's going against another lady who seems to be more in tune with the Democratic Party there, so I don't know if she can beat him or her, and then who knows if she can.
It's more of a history.
Okay, history. Well, whatever. So then, but the conversation with Kevin is, I always start thinking about other stuff. I go, okay, wait a minute. What if either one of these ladies or the guy running against them, Republican guy, what if one of those three is the second coming of Solomon and actually is bright, can get people together, has some ideas? How many terms, how long before they make any kind of an impact on the mess we've seen in the last 15 years? I mean, is it even possible to turn the ship from somebody who's 39, 40, and they all look like they're pretty young, Kevin? So what does that mean? When do they get to, if one of them, well, one of them's going to get elected, one of the three, suppose they're just the person we want in there, Kevin, and they got energy out the ass, what's it going to take for one of them to make a difference? Will they ever?
Well, don't we have a current example of that?
Who? We had Barack Obama, but I don't know, I'm not sure I want to go up with that one.
We've made a lot of fun of her, but you know, having AOC and her, and her kind of I'll go with ilk, you know, her squad people and all, haven't they very much turned the Democratic Party farther left than ever before?
You know, I don't,
you know, I mean, for a long time, you know, Pelosi was all about keeping her in check. But as Pelosi's power started to wane, you know, all of a sudden you are seeing, I mean, you're seeing that party elect more socialists at local levels. You know, Schumer's had his wings clipped by them to the point where he, you know, he may get primaried, but if he's not primaried, he may get thrown out of the minority leader position. I mean, they've kind of taken over that.
I don't know what. To be honest, Kevin, I can't. I'm having trouble answering your question because I don't know the New York situation. I know, on the one hand,
it's not just New York. It's Seattle. It's Minneapolis.
But it's also,
they all have people who are very proud to say, I'm a socialist.
I don't think they even know what it means.
Well, they may or may not, but they're very proud of saying it. You go back to Obama's days. They fought saying that word any time they could. You know, people would accuse him of being the European-style socialist. No, that's not us. That was a dirty word for them at the time.
Well, I think it, to me, it's a pretty much a dirty word. I don't like that system at all. But I think, Kevin, and I honestly don't think, even though you like to disagree, I think right now we don't have another word. It's something that's something different than the crony capitalism that everybody seems to recognize we're wanting our way into. This is not a Democrat Republican.
It's crony socialism instead.
But it's not. It doesn't mean. So it means something other than what we have. I mean, I think when during the Depression, when Armin Hammer's father went to some, you know, a couple of communist sort of things, and ended up pretty much in jail for it. I don't think he was a communist. He just thought the current situation wasn't the good one. there doesn't seem to be another word. I mean, I think the word right now we're rolling toward is not communism, socialism, or democracy. It's a plutocracy. It's people with the money going to run everything. It's going to be middle-aged feudal stuff. I mean, the politics are so intertwined. The media is also intertwined with the people with money that's where your group is. It has nothing to do with capitalism. It has nothing to do with socialism. But, I mean, I look at Chicago, I look at New York, and I don't like what's going on either, Kevin, but this guy wins. Is the best anybody come up with on the other side is the fourth retread of Cuomo?
Well, it's a one-party city, just like Chicago is.
But it's not really a party. These guys aren't any party. They're just, I mean, what's Johnson's party?
Well, let me put it this way: there is no opposition in New York, and that's a shame. And that's what, you know, we can call it Republicans, we can just call it conservatives. It doesn't matter. That they have no articulate opposition is their own damn fault.
But the competition.
So you're right. So what are we looking at?
Well,
what are we looking at for choices? Your conservative choice was Curtis Sliwa, who, you know, in some ways is, you know, has been an interesting person over the years, but not capable of running the city any more than Mondami is.
Well, normally when we're jousting, Kevin, I have an opinion and a point of view. I'll say this: I am totally befuddled by what's happening. I go back two or three elections here in Chicago, and I see. Well, for those that don't know, and maybe you know better than me, Chicago. When you say the conservatives are Democrat, you don't run as a Democrat or Republican anymore. You have everybody throws their name in a hat. You have this big primary where there could be 10, 12 people on there. And I don't even, you know, some could be Republicans. Nobody even says who they are, although you assume they're Democrats.
Yeah, it's
whatever that means.
Partisan, much like the Wisconsin Supreme Court, judge elections, they're nonpartisan, but it is clearly where the support is clearly aligned along party lines.
Well, sure it is, but I'm saying is these people, nobody votes for it. You have some incredible low voter turnout because people don't even understand the system. And you see, I mean, when Lori Lightfoot, well, there was two elections ago, or one election ago, in the primary election, she got, Kevin, was it 90,000 votes out of a city of 2.7 million people? That puts her in the runoff. And if she's running against Tony Preckwinkle, who nobody likes, so all of a sudden she's in. I'm like, who the hell is she? She only got 90,000 votes. I didn't say she was horrible. She was dumber. I said, this is not. I mean, and then, you know, to be perfectly blunt, a lot of the white people are all pissed off that we had her and we got this guy. Well, for God's sake, if they got off your dead ass 8 blocks in Mount Greenwood in the north side and went down to the election thing, you'd have had your own person, but nobody even did it. I'm so befuddled by the whole thing, Kevin, I almost can't even debate it. I don't know what to debate. Nobody pays any attention, then you're pissed off at what you got. Isn't it nuts?
I mean, well, and I think big city politics is largely that way. I think the more you get away from the bigger cities, the more it starts to resemble what we all know it to be, what we've always known it to be. I even go back to the days of the elder Mayor Daley, who was, you know, dynastic in his approach. I once had one of my aunts tell me I would never vote for him unless I thought he was going to lose.
Well, I mean, you know what though? I mean, city ran well, and his son did not run it the same way.
He always said, "Good government is good politics, and good politics is good government."
And it was you mentioned earlier in the show. The line, what's the moral line? And in Daley's day, it was a patronage system. And there was some civil service, mostly it was patronage. And some of my professors at the University of Chicago, notably George Stigler, said if I were to spend 6 months and had three or four people helping me, you know, some flunkies got to do the work, and did a huge study, patronage versus civil service. Civil service means you take tests and it's not political, and, you know, anything can ever not be political. But he said, I'm going to say that the patronage system works better, which was He said it to a group of us one night, and he goes, don't repeat that. He goes, I think the patron system, but there's a line. If you went to the alderman, went to Mayor Daley, and you said, hey, my buddy Kevin's out of a job, you know, you got to help him out, he's got a family and so forth. Kevin, you'd have a job. It wouldn't be president of the city, it wouldn't be, but you would have a job, and in those days, a job meant you could eat and feed your family. I mean, it didn't make a lot, but you... Any kind of, hell, if you were an assistant manager at a jewel store, you had a house and you had a crummy car, but you had a house and a car and a family. It's a different world. So all that meant is I'd have to go work a precinct or something. There was some give. Maybe he might call me and say, this other guy's running for judge, he needs $100. There was some of that. There was always a little, I'll use the term, grease. Not the same as giving somebody a bunch of dough and all of a sudden ended up with some contract on the Ryan where you make $40 billion, nobody could even compete. There was a little, because human nature seems to like a little grease, there was just that much grease. And as my uncle said to me once, he was a pretty bright guy, he goes, Tom, everybody sees the level of corruption and they're happy with it. It's not out of hand. He said, don't ever think there's not going to be any. Don't ever think it should be extreme. There's always going to be a little, and as long as it's just a little, and everybody has a certain set of morals, it's okay. That's how we work as human beings. And it was, I'm sitting there going, you know, I'm 21 years old at Notre Dame. Here's my uncle telling me this, and he goes, it's at a level that everybody accepts. What do you think of that?
Well, it's probably a wise insight, and it's probably true, at least in terms of effectiveness. And yes, it offends a lot of moral sensibilities, but the current situation should offend them even more.
Well, let me ask you another, take it from the other side, which is what both you and I think do pretty well, and that's why we love jousting with each other. Take it from the other side. If Kevin O'Neill decides he wants to all of a sudden, you know, put up O'Neill's hot dogs. Now, there's a system for permits and all this other kind of crap, and which maybe isn't the best, but say there is a system. All of a sudden, you pop into my office, and I'm an alderman, or whatever I am, and you say, hey, Tom, somehow or another, you got to get me to the front of the line. You know, my investors want this thing up in 6 months, not a year, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, in other words, how can you help me with this? It's going to be 15 jobs. It's going to be this, that, and the other thing. Okay. Why exactly, and if I say, okay, Kevin, boy, you know, I could sure use some help next Tuesday at the 12th precinct, and I'm with somebody out front handing out my flyers. And you say, up yours. Well, that's not right either, is it? I mean, I don't like somebody getting in front of the line for somebody else, but why should anybody do anything for anybody for nothing? I'm not asking you for your second kid or to give me your new car. Hey, can you help me out next Tuesday? Oh, bleep you. Okay, well, that's interesting. I mean, how does it work the other way?
Yes, I will remember, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm saying, there. Whenever you ask somebody to do something, I mean, obviously, if you're friends, you do stuff back and forth all the time. But if it's only all one way, even friends, you're going to go, wait a minute. Hey, I asked you a favor. I've done 15 for you, and you told me no. How's this even? Right? I mean, there's some... Everybody goes to these people, they want a favor.
This is how we live our lives. This is normal.
Yeah.
I do happen to believe that, that by doing for others, you do tend to gain a lot. And you're always better off doing without expecting anything in return. But there are times when you do need somebody else's help, and when you have helped out, and then that person turns you down just because, you know, I mean, there's good reasons, but that person turns you down because I don't want them. That gets to be, okay, I remember that then. I will remember.
Well, look at the Eddie Burke situation. I don't know where he went. I have a feeling, Kevin, because people that you know as well had told me a few years ago that he was, I'll use the term, crossing the line. And matter of fact, one of the guys said to me, he must be getting old and senile. What's he doing? Now, Eddie Burke, for those that didn't know, also ran a tax... Alderman's a part-time job. He also ran a tax appeals operation. He had one, Madigan had one, Tom Tully has one, there's a couple other people have. And these guys, you know, will, if you have your taxes, property taxes, they will appeal them if you think they're too high. And a lot of times they are. If you got a building downtown now that's empty, you better have one of those guys, because if they're going to send you a bill like the place full. But anyway, so here's where I think the line is. If somebody comes to him and wants, you know, a zoning variance or something, and Eddie helps you out with it, because there's all kinds of zoning variances. You call the zoning laws are arcane, and he helps you out with it. And if he puts a card on the table and says, you know, I also have a tax business, give my guys a call. If they're competitive, you know, just give them a shout. If they're competitive, use them. If they don't, use somebody else. You know, if you like them, do. Otherwise, but you know, you owe us at least an interview. I'm okay with that. Now, if he says,
I am too.
And now, if he says, you're not going to get a permit unless you use my tax service, now I got a problem. That to me is that's too far.
It's total quid pro quo, and it's on its face, it's illegal.
So. Yeah. So I mean, I got no. But I mean, couldn't you give the guy a shutout? I mean, I would say that if all of a sudden Stocks and Jacks had a, you know, or Mercedes dealer that sponsored us, and you like listening to the show every day, I don't expect somebody to just go to that guy and pay more for a car just because he listens to the show. But if the guy's down the block from you, can't you at least give him a shout? I mean, if you listen to the show for free?
Yeah, well, I'll give you a different example. Yeah. Because in my days in banking and, you know, in IT, I used to get the commercial lenders used to always ask me, you know, would you consider, this is a really good customer, would you consider buying your computers or your networking equipment from this company? You know, the answer was, yeah, but I'm not going to guarantee him the business. And I said, well, it's a really good customer. We should throw something back their way. And I said, if I take the delta, if I take the extra that I have to pay this guy and I charge it to your department, are we okay with that? How good a customer is it then when you do the P&L on the customer? You know, when I go take off, you know, enough thousands of dollars on that customer's individual profitability. And then I would get the, oh, okay.
What if he matches the price?
But I would always promise to give him a shot.
Yeah, I mean, why wouldn't you?
And, yeah, I was always happy to do that. So, you know, that we're describing the same thing, whether it's in the, you know, public or whether it's private business. It doesn't matter. It's the same thing.
Well, there was a scene from, what was that wacky movie where the, Was it the Survivor, the Lone Survivor? What's his name? Keanu Reeves? Who's a?
Oh, are you talking about Tom Hanks?
No. It was what's his name?
It was a TV show called Designated Survivor.
Hey, Dr. Larissa Damiak. Happy Wednesday.
How are you? Good morning, everybody.
Well, there was
morning,
a.
Larissa. How are you doing today?
Well, there was. I've been listening to your conversation about Chicago politics.
Well, it's I've been in it for. We've been here for like a long time. Anyway, this scene in the show was everybody gets killed except the designated survivor. For those that don't know, every time there's a State of the Union message or something, they pluck like the lowest level cabinet guy and they move him to a place of safety. So if a plane lands, which essentially did, or it blows up in the movie, and there's one guy left. It's what's his name's kid, Donald Sutherland's.
Kiefer Sutherland.
Yeah, Kiefer Sutherland. So he's the guy.
Are you talking about the TV show 24?
No, it was after 24.
It was after 24.
It was called Designated Survivor.
Yeah.
And so he was a cabinet member. He would have been like Secretary of Transportation or something. Nobody was going to consider him as the president. But they always leave some cabinet member behind so that there is some kind of succession, because, you know, all the rest of the cabinet, the president's given the State of the Union, Speaker of the House is there, the President Pro Tem of the Senate, you know, all the succession. So they want to leave one succession person there. And then the way the story goes in the first episode in the State of the Union, there's a bomb at the State of the Union, and it kills them all. So now Kiefer Sutherland's the president, and I think it lasted one season.
It was actually pretty. You know who was one of those one time? Remember your guy in Wisconsin, Kevin? Remember Tommy Thompson?
Yeah, I remember Tommy.
Well, he became secretary of health or something, or education.
Yeah, something like that. Well, I know he was in the cabinet, but yeah, he was a very popular governor in Wisconsin.
Well, when the movie came out, evidently he was one of the designated survivors one night. He goes, he thought he was going to the speech, and they come and get him. The Secret Service, they go, no, you're not going to the speech. And they plunk him in his car and whisk him to some hotel, and he's watching the speech in there. And then when it's over and everybody left and nobody got killed, they go, see ya. He had to call a cab to get home. They didn't even drive him home.
Say, you got an Uber account?
So anyway, but they put this together, and this is what we're kind of going back and forth between banking. We did a big thing yesterday with Hal about banking laws that essentially drive banks to make loans to big people and not little people.
Right.
And we had a big thing about that with Hal yesterday because he's doing some research on it. But anyway, he gets together where he's trying to put together a Supreme Court and a Congress, and of course they had elections. But he gets a group together for the Supreme Court, and he goes, and one lady says, here's the solution. Because nobody really wanted him to be president. They wanted to wait till the next election. He goes, how about if you give me four judges from your side, and you give me four judges for your side, and if I win the next election, or whoever the next guy is, he appoints the ninth judge for the cases that are that controversial. He goes, but he goes, face it, 80% of the cases, 85, are not all that controversial. We can do 85% of the government's business, just routine, and every once in a while we need the ninth vote, and we'll just wait 6 months for that, and everybody goes, okay. And you wonder if we could even do that now, Kevin, if a lot of the government's business is at a point where both sides go, yeah, we got to do that. Come on, guys, quit arguing for an hour, and let's do that. And really, is it all this confrontational? It shouldn't be.
But it is.
I know. I mean, every single issue seems to be...
Well, every major issue, because, things like the Supreme Court, and there is some, non-significant legislation that coasts on through Congress as well, but the Supreme Court has lots of decisions that are not divided. They don't get a lot of publicity.
Yeah, you never hear about them.
Some of them are substantial. It's not the stuff that we that gets a lot of airtime, but the Supreme Court actually is a reasonably functional organization.
What do you think, before I let you go, What's your vote? Where's this tariff thing going to come down?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think there's a lot of concern that undoing it will, and this should not be the concern, but I think there's a lot of concern that undoing it will be too unwieldy. I think they'll probably clip Trump's wings somewhat, but not entirely.
Why? Let me ask you this, and I this is just a dumbo question. I want Larissa's cue on this as well. If you decide, I think it's illegal, but that's my opinion. I don't really have any feel that we should go through the mechanism of giving the money back. I don't see how you do that. If I went to Walmart and bought something for $50 and there was a $4 tariff on it, they're never going to get me that $4 check. Just leave it alone and drop it going forward. And to me, there's no way you can do that properly. Don't even try. I mean, how's that for a crummy vote?
If they do that, Tom, that'll be the next lawsuit. Then is the next thing that's going to find its way to the Supreme Court.
But who's going to give the money to? Walmart, and they're not going to give it to me. I mean, how do you even go about doing it?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it should wind up with the consumer to the extent that the consumer has paid it. It's a dicey issue. Like I said, I think they will probably establish, and the court won't establish this. They'll throw it down, or they'll throw it to Congress and say there's got to be a litmus test for this. You can't just have the vague wording, because the wording of the statute that they're using to to claim national security on this is very vague and very broad. So you could easily decide the case just saying, well, it's a pretty broad statement, so the discretion involved is pretty broad. That could happen, but this is me talking. I am not in any way expert on the constitutional effects of it. So that might be a really good Lou discussion tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking Larissa might have some ideas on this too. I mean, it's kind of weird, but then you have I don't know if you're allowed to play tapes in front of the Supreme Court, but the one guy, and I don't know how you say stuff like this, the one dude, I don't think it was, might have been Secretary of Treasury, I'm not sure it was, because I was listening on the radio, and what's her name, whatever show it was, says, so how do you define an emergency? And the guy goes, an emergency is anything the president says it is. And I go, please, don't play that one in front of the Supreme Court. No,
yeah, no kidding.
That sounds awful. I mean, I just... You can't do that. But anyway, Kevin, Friday we'll go over how come the Irish, no matter what happens here, are they going to stay ninth forever so they don't get the home game or what?
There's a lot yet to come because conference championship games are going to knock some people out of this. And so, for instance, you're looking at like a TCU. If Brigham Young beats them, they're out. If they beat up Brigham Young, then Brigham Young's completely out of it, and that won't happen. I think you're going to see some stuff like that in the SEC as well. I don't know what's going to happen with the ACC. It would be nice if Pittsburgh were to go beat Miami this week, but I don't know if they will. But
what is it? Are the four conference championship? They don't get to buy anymore. It's the top four teams, right?
Right, but they get in.
They get in.
So you know, from looking at it from my Notre Dame interest, you start counting. You know, how many are they going to get? So if you just start counting, you say the Big Ten three, potentially four, but three. SEC might get four. That's seven. ACC is going to get one, eight, nine. You get the Big 12, and then you get the Group of Five. That's 10. Okay, now let's start counting additional ones. You put Notre Dame in, that's 11, 12, 13, and then there's only a spot number 12 left. Now when you start saying extra ACC team or extra Big 12 team, then it gets, it starts to get dicey as to who's going to get that last spot or the last two spots. So,
you also want to.
That's kind of the interesting look of the next couple of weeks is you start, you're looking at people jockeying for that position. There's going to be two lost teams in the tournament this year. It's just a matter of which two lost teams it's going to be.
Well, also the way you're positioned, if the Irish are now ninth, okay, and people don't care about the Irish, but the point is they're ninth, so they would have to play number eight. The number eight would host. Okay, so
yeah. You
like to be eight because you at least get the host, but you don't also want to be in the eighth or ninth slot because the winner of that game is going to go play Ohio State, which you probably don't want to do. So if you can make it to seven, then you get to play the tenth team, and if you win, you go to play Indiana, who's really really good too. But I don't think they're Ohio State in terms of personnel, so you have a better chance I think against Indiana than you do Ohio State, and you got to hope that somebody else knocks off Ohio State along the way, or else you get murdered by them in the final. Okay.
And Tom, you'll know more soon because Indiana and Ohio State are going to play.
Yeah, that'll be, and then they got to play again in what, 3 weeks?
No, they don't have a regularly scheduled game. They will play in the championship.
Okay, I thought they had a regular. They don't. Okay.
No, but they're in line to be one and two there, so they're going to play in the Big Ten championship.
Could there be anything dumber than that?
A lot of this stuff's going to fall into place. Everybody's going to argue about who the 12th team is. And if you're the 12th team in, you're probably not going to go very far anyway. You could, it's possible.
Well, you got to play number five.
Yeah.
But if you're an SEC team, they're all pretty even.
If you're say it's Alabama is the 12th team in, or say it's Notre Dame. Notre Dame can beat anybody. I think that's a team that can play ball with Ohio State.
I don't think there's any chance of that for the Irish.
I think they're more equipped to play against Ohio State this year than they were last year, and then in the championship game.
If Notre Dame wins their next two, they're 7 or 8. If they lose one, they're gone. I don't think there's a chance of them being 12.
If they lose to either Syracuse or Stanford, they deserve to be gone.
Yeah. All right. Talk to you Friday, bud.
Their odds to win those games are like 98 and 99, something like that.
That doesn't scare me, though. It does a while. Anyway, it does. Anybody can win, The turnovers. Anyway, bud, talk to you on Friday.
All right. See ya. You guys have a good rest of the
Kevin.
Show.
Hi, Kevin.
Larissa, how are you? How was your week? What's going on?
Things are A-OK. we're getting ready for Thanksgiving at the university, and it's a lot of fun.
How many people there? I'll go back to my Notre Dame days. How many people hang around Thanksgiving?
So this is my first Thanksgiving here. I have no idea.
Because they pretty much booted everybody. We always had a guy or two at our place, you know, because we were in Chicago, and I think everybody had to move to one dorm. I'll bet out of the 6,500 people, maybe 200 stuck around.
Sure.
I mean, you were very much encouraged to take your roommate home with you if you had nowhere to go.
Right.
and people did. I mean, a lot of people couldn't afford the flight to L.A. or something and back, and so yeah, a lot of people did. I mean, but I don't. They really didn't want people hanging around.
Well, I've seen lots of different signs about cafeterias being closed. So I think that's also a good motivation to find somewhere else to go if there's no place to eat.
Oh, yeah, especially if you're at that age, you need your chow.
Mm-hmm.
It is amazing how much people eat at that age, isn't it? When you're doing stuff all day. I could stand to lose a couple of pounds, but I'll tell you what, I'd probably eat a fifth of what I used to.
Yeah, my 8-year-old is a huge fan of turkey.
Oh, God.
And he loves to eat the entire turkey leg and thigh. I'm like, okay.
I'm a leg and thigh guy and the bird myself. I'd much rather dark meat than the white meat. But which is great because everybody else wants the white meat, so we sure. Coalesce. Are you cooking or are you traveling?
I'll probably do some of both. So I'll probably travel the day of Thanksgiving, and then I have other family fun planned for later in the weekend, and I'll be doing a lot of cooking for that.
Don't tell me you're the one who brings a bean casserole.
No, I'm a gluten-free, so I bring the gluten-free pumpkin pie.
Ah.
Nobody wants to touch that.
We had an aunt for how many friggin' years, all she did was she always brought the bean casserole, no matter what it was. And it was back in those days when people didn't have, like, refrigerators like you have now. They were always canned beans.
Oh, I know.
And my mother would say, oh, you got to eat some of Aunt Sally's beans, even if you don't like them, you got to eat some.
I know.
But now bean casseroles are great if you use fresh beans, but... Nobody had that. We had that ability in those days.
No, and I grew up with the canned green bean casserole, and they put the things in the top and the crunchy layer, and you're like, all right.
Well, the crunchy layer is the one thing that saved it a little bit.
Right, because it gave it a little bit of flavor.
So this week we've been, since you are can talk on just about every subject. I don't know how much you've been able to listen in, but we went through a lot of the stuff for the veterans, and every day. Instead of coming up with solutions, we came up with essentially more questions, different levels, because we started with Diane talking about some of the psychological problems in the regular veterans community where people are in there with, no arms and legs and cancer and all that stuff, and the new issues because one of the veterans' homes is up in Great Lakes where they actually have, in that hospital, they have active duty people in the hospital that are hurt or have mental issues. So that's kind of a combined, it's the only one in the country. And then Kenny Polcari's group, they're helping people that are veterans that are not going through the veteran system because they'll get to you a lot quicker. And we went through all that stuff. Then Hal yesterday brought up all these things in the banking things. I don't know if you had a chance to listen to that, but I probably should send you what he sent me. Of course, he had it so small I could barely read it. But it had to do with a big summary of the current banking regulations and how we've gone from reserve requirements to these capital requirements, and all they really do is make it so much more beneficial for a bank to give one loan to somebody rich or a big company, because the capital requirements are a lot less than if you give out 40 loans to local plumbing and electrical companies, which I suspected, Larissa, but I never really put my finger on actually in there. And I'm reading this stuff, and it's horrifying. I mean, who even thought of that stuff? Obviously, big banks, but one of my themes for a long time has been the reason why the middle class is being destroyed is because the difference in the ability to raise capital. And I never could really put my finger on it, and obviously, there's all other stuff to it, but what's your opinion on that? I know part of the Dodd-Frank that somebody told me, if you're a plumbing company, you probably got to give a personal guarantee, even though the corporation might be doing $10 million a year and never missed a payment. They still want a personal guarantee out of you, or they want your house or something, which you know, I think if you're married to a plumber and he came back and said, I just gave these guys a deed to the house, you'd probably whack him with a cast iron pan. But, you know, I mean, what's your opinion on all of it? It's kind of crazy, isn't it? As we say, we're helping these people out. We're doing exactly the opposite.
Well, I think that the challenge is the risk management component of it, right? How do you quantify who's more risky, one entity versus another? And I think the motivation behind it is your plumber is much more risky than your large bank or your large corporation.
Well, that's what people think, but is it true?
I don't know. I've not done the research. I was going to say, well, of course it's true. But then I thought back to 2008 when we thought that everybody always paid back their mortgage. I don't know one way or the other if it's true or not true. My assumption is that it's true, but I'd be curious to see how they created their risk model for plumbers and compare it to their risk model for a large corporation. So if the models are very different, then we're in a situation where there's a inherent bias against the plumber. And I make this argument because when we do valuations for equities, one of the things we do is we create our own credit rating. This is something I teach my students to do. And it utilizes a bunch of accounting ratios and coverage and things like that, which is what the big three like S&P and Moody's and Fitch should be utilizing to really have a deeper understanding of the credit and the credit risk of that large corporation. So if the large corporation has all that data, it's a lot easier to understand and to model how much capital requirements are necessary. If you don't have that information for the plumber, you're going to have to make a lot of assumptions. And those assumptions usually aren't going to be as friendly as it would be for that large corporation. And again, part of it's just lack of data, but I'd also be curious if the models are different.
Well, I think because what the theme of it was, I mean, you're not as old as me, hopefully. I know you're not. When we learned banking, there was always the reserve requirement, and it was a real number. And evidently, I mean, I know we've dropped the reserve requirement down to like zero. I didn't really know what had replaced it. Although, of course, I had some clue that something was weird because, I don't know if you knew this or not, I mentioned it yesterday, but because you're here, I'll mention it again. One of my buddies who now is retired, but I used to get all this stuff from the guys from the Federal Reserve because they drink in the same bar, right, as the Traders Bar. Well, now none of them go to work. They're all doing stuff from home, which is a little weird. But so anyway, I haven't seen these guys in ages, but at one point, the clearing agents, you know, Board of Trade Clearing, OCC, DTS, what's the other one? DTS, whatever the stock clearing firm is, brain fart. Those groups can have a lot of money one day and not the next. So it got to the point where I knew something was weird because my buddy Robert said, you know, if the Board of Trade Clearing wanted to give, you know, $80 million or $100 million one night to a bank, the bank didn't want it. And I'm like, wait a minute. what do you mean a bank doesn't want it? Well, because it's considered fast money, it affects their net capital. They actually have to have more capital if the money gets deposited there. And I'm like, that makes no sense. No, that's the way the Dodd-Frank or whatever rules are. So they didn't want the money. So you couldn't, maybe Jamie Dimon himself had to approve a deposit of that size.
Sure.
And because it affected his capital, let me get this straight. It's a bank. You can't give them money and they don't make loans. What the hell is a bank doing? Isn't that what they do, right? It's like, duh.
Right.
So anyway, they ended up giving the clearing agents, OCC and those people, a direct line to the Fed. So if they had this extra money, they could deposit it at the Fed without going through a bank because the bank didn't want it. And I never put two and two together that this was part of a bigger picture here where somehow it's now capital requirements instead of reserve requirements. And I knew the reserve requirements went down. I just never had a feeling that these new requirements had taken their place. And I don't know that the other ones seem pretty simple, right? Somebody puts $100 in the bank, you can loan out 80 of it. I mean, you know, the new ones, I'm not so sure they're that simple, and I'm not so sure they're that good. Do you have any inkling here that more than me?
No, I don't have that much more of an inkling than you. I think you and I are leaning in the same direction of the complicated nature of some of these rules don't seem to be achieving the objective or what we assume should be the objective for the banking system.
Well, we think the objective is to give small people a good shake. I'm not so sure the big people think that's the objective.
I agree that I don't think that's what they think of the objective. And it's, you know, you also have to question what is the profitability in these smaller loans. So if you've got higher risk, and again, we haven't been able to establish that it truly is higher risk. We have an assumption that it's higher risk, but if we have higher risk and a lower rate of return, that's not a good investment.
Well, I think they charge more, but it also comes down to if you're going to have a, you now need a loan department, right? I mean, you need people that are doing this. It's a hell of a lot easier just to, hey, you know, Amazon wants how many million? Here they go, you know, type of thing. But I mean, Amazon's not paying as much as the other guys.
No, it's not.
Well, plus it's levels of risk. I mean, it's not. I mean, when you, I mean, if it's Larissa and Tom Plumbing Company, if we're looking for a loan, probably it's because we have a 3-month job and we're going to get paid at the end of the job. Well, now it's not just our risk, it's the risk on the other guy. Are we going to get paid or not? I mean, we're going to do our end, but what if the other guy goes broke, the big guy at the other end? I mean, it's, so there's kind of levels of risk to that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and why, you know, I don't know, are you getting progress payments? That's why I would never even consider, if it was our company, you got to at least pay for the material. I mean, I'll front you the labor or my sweat, but we're not paying material. At the end, we don't pay us. We're totally out of business. So, I mean, there's levels on each end, right? Pretty complicated. Do you teach a lot of this stuff to people?
Nope. Right now, I am teaching more personal finance things. So, for example, I teach a class called Retirement, and I teach a class called Estate Planning. And we've just gone through an exercise where the students have to create a will so that they can leave assets to their pet. Because
really?
It's a big thing. And there are interesting laws around leaving assets to a pet. The previous week, I think you might find this entertaining, is we had students leave assets to their favorite organization. And it didn't have to be a charity. So, for example, the NFL has a lot of rules around how you leave assets to the Chicago Bears.
Why would anybody want to do that?
I don't know, but apparently it's a thing. There are lots of rules around it, and I found it, to me personally, highly entertaining that somebody would want to do this.
I can't imagine who that could be.
You know, it's like, okay.
Good Lord.
But I wanted to, you were talking with Kevin about the distribution of the tariff payments. What a legal or a logistic nightmare.
Well, that's what I'm saying to me. I just let it go. Say, forget it.
Yeah, I mean, like the amount of money it will cost to be able to find the exact payments, it would be, again, logistical nightmare. For doing that, and you've got to have people who are willing to, or who can demonstrate that they purchased something. So you're going to have to go through receipts. You're going to have a department to be able to distribute the checks. You're going to have checks and balances to make sure the proper amount's going to the proper people. And again, just from a logistics standpoint, all I can see is a bunch of red tape.
Well, let's take one of them. Let's say it's a Ford. You know, what do they say? Fix or repair daily. A Ford. If you just went out there and plunked down $45,000 for a Ford, and all of a sudden this gets repealed, or whatever they're going to do to it, if Ford says our tariff costs were $5,000 a car, and we didn't raise our prices at all, we ate the $5,000. Well, then I guess the check goes to Ford if they can prove that. But if they say it was $35,000 and now it's $40,000. I think the check goes to you. Who the hell's going to do all that?
Well, and then there's, in that specific example, I believe there was, if it's more, so let's say the board charged people a higher rate than the tariff, there's going to be an uncomfortable lawsuit regarding that as well.
Well, you can always raise prices. I mean, that's what cartels do.
Right.
What the hey? In your class, I hope I'm not gonna jump you with this one, but in your retirement class, there seems to be, and I'm not an expert on this. My brother knows more than me, but there seems to be a big wave now of commercials where they want people to change from their regular IRA, pay all the taxes, and roll it into a Roth. I'm stumped as to why all of a sudden that's becoming popular. Is that something you're talking about?
It's not something I am talking about, but I do see issues with healthcare costs, and we have a big situation where we have the boomer generation as they are retiring and they are dealing with some of these things. The consolidation of these accounts, I think, is beneficial to them because it simplifies. So, for example, you could have a boomer who was lucky and has a pension, right? So they've got a pension coming in, they've got Social Security coming in, they've got their 401k, they've got their assets, and they also
pension. What's that?
Right. Well, some boomers still have a pension, and yeah. It might not be a very large pension, depending on when the boomer joined the pension program. But my point is, we're looking at some boomers that have multiple streams of income coming in.
Let's go to break, but then let's continue this because it's a serious subject for our people, and a lot of clients are asking me now about, because you're seeing commercials on TV roll. And I just have all kinds of questions about it. Because I've had three or four people ask me in the last week, and I go, let me find out. Somebody knows more than me, because I can see all kinds of problems with that, possibly. S&P Futures up 20, NASDAQ Futures up 96. We're going to try and come back from the last few days, which have been really ugly. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years I've seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom. We got Andrew on the board. S&P Futures down 17. Up 17, sorry. Last few days, I'm so used to saying down. NASDAQ is up 86, so we're trying to make our move here. NVIDIA earnings tonight, which obviously will be a big deal, because he said in the next however many years, they're going to have $500 billion in income or revenue. We'll see if that happens, or he reiterates that tonight. So tonight's a big night in earnings. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX. And these guys are down like 3%, or they were down a bunch yesterday. It was the Nikkei that was down 3%. But they're coming back a little bit, 38 points, 0.1%, so not much. FTSE's down again, down 18.2%, CAC around down 94 cents. Let's call it unchanged. So there's no kind of a big bounce over in Europe, at least as of yet. Asia, Nikkei's down another 165. It'll be down 3% yesterday. It's 0.3%. Hang Seng down 99. They were down heavy yesterday as well. Another 0.4%. Shanghai, however, is bouncing a little bit, up 7.2%. So no big comeback here. I don't want to say it's a dead cat bounce, but close. Get a load of this, though. Oil down $1.85, $58.89. Brent down $1.86, $63.03. Oil has been just an abject loser this last 6 months. Gold up 38 bucks, 41.04, so over 4,100. Silver up $1.20, 51.73. It's good for, we got a lot of people involved in silver and gold. It's good for the good guys here today. We'll see if that holds. I mean, it's been up and down. It's becoming very volatile. By the way, the implied volatility in some of the GDX now is like 45. It's normally 30. So whatever you plan on doing option-wise, you better be ready to play, pay to play. Euro dollar, 115.7, so that's unchanged. British pound, same thing, 131. Crypto, which has been getting clobbered, is getting, well, it's down again today. 1,300, 91,480. It actually traded under 90 at one point yesterday. So it's down from a high of 126. So if there was pushing, I think Russell was a gentleman. We said he thought the total wealth in all these cryptocurrencies was pushing $3 trillion when it was up around 125. If he was correct, which Russell usually is, it means we've shed damn near a trillion from the top now, not from the bottom, in wealth in these cryptocurrencies. And I'm going to get Dr. Demiak's opinion on that, because if you borrowed money to buy it higher, it's going to leave a mark. If you bought it, you know, at 10,000, you're still okay, I think, even though you're down from what you were. Andrew, what do you have for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
All right, it is 7:36 here in Chicago, Wednesday, November 19th. Just a little bit of sports here. The Blackhawks won over the Flames last night. That was 5-2. And over in basketball, the Suns won over the Trailblazers, 127-110. For Chicago weather, it's currently 44 degrees right now. Going to be a high of just one more, 45. We're going to have cloudiness all throughout the day, so it's going to stay pretty cool. Over in Phoenix, a little bit different story. They're currently at 59 degrees, mostly cloudy, but cool with a couple of showers and a heavy thunderstorm. Continued risk for flash flooding. They're going to have high of 63. And finally, for Chicago traffic, things are looking heavy on basically every inbound expressway. Thankfully, no accidents to report. But you're coming in on the Kennedy, about O'Hare to the Jane Burns, going to take you about 51 minutes. Eden's Deerfield to Jane Burns, going to take you about another 51. And Eisenhower, Thorndale to Jane Burns, going to take you about 54. That's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Larissa, yeah, how much of the, get back on what we were kind of talking about, how much of the issue with the regular IRA versus the Roth has to do with the premiums on the Medicare stuff now?
I looked it up. I pulled out my textbook and looked up the benefits for this, and it's really around taxes and avoiding the minimum distribution for once you start into retirement. So when we think about tax reduction, we're looking at locking in maybe a lower tax rate than what you're going to be paying in the future. You can migrate those funds if you anticipate that you're going to be in a higher tax bracket. You can defer some of your taxes. So the conversion is then going to be included in your taxable income.
If you close out your IRA, you have to pay ordinary income on the whole thing, correct?
I believe so. And if you transfer it, roll it over to the Roth, you allows for you to change how you pay for that taxes.
Well, one of the flies in the ointment is, and I didn't realize this, but anybody who is over 65 and has Medicare, the Part A is, I'll use the term included, I won't say free. Part B, if you want the doctor, it's about $200 a month for just about everybody. If you make more money, though, it ratchets up. So if you say you've got a big honking IRA and your minimum distribution is, say, $500,000 a year, your Medicare thing goes up to almost $600 a month.
And this is one way to try to mitigate that, because you can reduce the minimum distribution. You can avoid that with a Roth IRA.
Well, I have a question for you in terms of stocks, though. Nobody has it. We have all kinds of people here with IRA. I don't know if any, well, there might have a couple that are just in T-bills or just in money markets, but virtually everybody has some stocks, Larissa. So what if it was yours, okay, and you were smart enough to buy, you know, whatever, 25 years ago, a whole bunch of Apple at 11 bucks, I mean, just say. And all of a sudden, your IRA is sitting there and it's $5 million. All right.
Sure.
So you say, well, I'm gonna take the hit this year. I think somehow or another, if this tariff thing goes away, these guys are gonna have to raise taxes, and I'm gonna pay my 35%, and I don't want it to be 40. All the reasons you just mentioned. And oh, by the way, I'll pay the difference in the Medicare for 1 year, but not 10 years. So you take the hit. Now, if everything you have is all cash, and then you roll it into a Roth, all cash, I'm thinking out loud here. I'm not giving advice here, but I could sort of understand that. But if you have this Apple stock that you've made $10 million on, if you sell the Apple stock and say that's it, again, I can kind of roll with this a hair. But if you move the Apple stock into the Roth and you pay taxes on the entire gain, and the next year Apple goes down 30%, where are you going to get that money back?
So I personally, and this is not advice, maybe very clear, I am not a CFP.
Me neither. It's just a question.
But that's not what I would do.
Okay.
So if I have this huge stock position in Apple, I would create a trust and move those assets into the trust.
Can you move from an IRA to a trust? I don't know if you can.
You can. You can move some of it to a trust.
Okay.
So, and if you move some of those assets into the trust, then you're avoiding some of that estate taxes, as well as, and then you're not forced to sell those assets. But this is under the assumption that you have enough assets that you don't need the Apple stock.
Right. Well, yeah, a lot of it goes away if you got a whole bunch of dough.
Yeah. Well, and then, again, those are different problems. But if you have a $5 million portfolio of simply Apple stock, most likely you're not in a situation where you're looking for other assets to be able to meet your Medicare payment. But going back to your Medicare payment, another reason why I might put all of those assets in a trust and name somebody else the beneficiary, name somebody else the fiduciary of this trust, is then it reduces the overall assets that you have that can be counted towards that Medicare and Medicaid cost. So one strategy for minimizing those costs is to reduce your income and to reduce the amount of money that you're receiving every single year, because it dramatically changes the cost.
Well, you know, we have a lot of clients, PTI, and we have people that have to take, you know, a required distribution of, you know, right, a couple hundred grand, and it creates problems, but a lot of other people would love to have the problem.
Right. Well, exactly. That's why if you've got a $5 million stock portfolio of just Apple stock, you're probably okay. And you're not in a situation. But again, to your point, it does create additional problems because your Medicare costs are going to go up. And it's an interesting problem. And it's an interesting problem that we're experiencing right now. So the amount of wealth that boomers have is actually, you know, a percentage of the boomers have is staggering. And interestingly, because women live longer than men, it's going to be a female problem. So how do you manage some of these assets to reduce taxes, to reduce your Medicare, and then to increase how much you can leave to your children, the next generation?
Well, I have it's kind of a weird feeling I have, because obviously, I'm a money manager, and I've been involved in stocks and options my whole life, and I love it. And my clients, it's terrific. I really like the idea that we don't force anybody into a plan just because it's our plan, and everything is individual for the person. And I like that. You know, I mean, because everybody is different. But the thing I'm really nervous about is, when I was a Ute, you saved money by, you know, making 100 hours a week, living on 80 and putting 20 in the bank. Not that you didn't invest it or any kinds of thing, but this whole idea that the entire wealth of the country now is in this massive run-up in stocks, to the point where by historical standards, are all pretty darn high. I just wonder if we see, and I'm not predicting this, and boy, oh boy, I hope it doesn't happen because I don't want my clients or me to go through it. If the market drops back to 30 or 40%, it's up in the last few years. I mean, we're going to decimate this wealth bubble. And by the way, if houses drop 20% on top of that, which they probably almost should to match people's incomes, now I'd much rather have incomes go up and not the housing prices come down, but there's a mismatch there. I think the wealth situation looks a hell of a lot different than it does now.
I think you're right. And I'm hoping that one of the things that I've seen within the CFP community is this push for structured products. So a lot of people are getting into these products, which then, as you know, limit the upside, but then also protect against the downside. So it's to some extent like a collar around their assets. And if the collar works properly, then hopefully we won't see a huge drop, particularly within the boomer generation in their assets. We're not going to see substantial growth, I hope.
Not so much PTI clients, because you know people come here because they have the attitude that you just talked about. But we've done some subcontract work, for lack of a better term. We've managed parts of other groups' money on the not a lot of people want to deal with concentration issues and things like that.
Sure.
My people and me, we're good at that. I mean, I've been doing this forever. I mean, for God's sake, you learn something in 20 years on the trading floor. So, you know, I have a skill set that most of these other people don't have. You know, a lot of people don't care about either, because most people don't care about risk management or so forth. But it's a skill set that most people don't have. And it is amazing how many people are 75, 80 years old. Again, these aren't PTI clients. Listen, they don't give a crap. They think this is going to go on forever. They don't see any reason whatsoever to protect anything. It's astounding to me that people are like, you know, to me it's not how much you make, it's how much you keep, you know. And they have, and also people, it's even weirder. Now you're going to think I'm nuts here, if you don't already. There's people who own a stock they bought at 10 and it's trading 100, and I say, no, you got a lot of wealth in here. Yeah, but I bought it at 10. If it goes back down to 70, what's the difference? And I go, the difference is $30. But you know, there is. Judge me on this. If you're on a trading floor, or if you're a client, if you walk in one day and you say, I got this stock at 60, I think I should protect it, and the next week you come in and it's 55, and you bought it at 10, you think you're up 45. I think we're down 5.
Sure.
I mean, but that's, in a trading floor, you mark yourself to market every day. Now, I'm not expecting retail people to do that, but a little of that, you know, if it's like at the blackjack table, it's not the house's money if it's on your side of the table. If you can get up and leave without being arrested, it's not the house's money anymore. It's yours.
It's your money.
But you're one of the few people I've ever talked to that understands it. That is, it hasn't been a trader.
Well, I've worked in the trading arena. I worked for a company called Peak Six.
Okay. Well, but I'm saying, how do you deal with a retail person that says, what's the problem? One of my buddies he hangs around in the same local bar. I won't say, he's got like 5 or 6 bitcoins. He bought it like 10 grand. I said, you know, the things are down 30 grand in the last week and a half. Ah, so what? I bought them at 10. What do you mean, so what? You're long 5 of them 5 times. Sorry, it's 150 grand. Ah, I don't care. It'll go back up. Okay, fine. I mean,
okay.
Okay, then. I mean, it is kind of weird, isn't it? Different people's approaches to risk.
Oh, absolutely, and that's why there's an entire field in finance dedicated to behavioral finance.
Yeah,
how do people actually respond? What are their motivations? And the idea of house money is an entire area of study.
Really?
This is a huge area of study, and it's a shame Russell's not on, because this is what he did his thesis on. But the idea of how do you utilize that money? How do you do mental accounting where you put some money in one bucket and other money, like the house money, in a different bucket? And I use when I teach this in class, I talk about a time I was at a nightclub in Philadelphia many years ago, and I found $750.
Really? In a wallet or just laying on the floor?
Laying on the floor.
$750. So seven Benjamins and a Grant sitting there.
Yep, $750. Wow. And it was a buddy and I. We both found it together, and we executed together because we were walking. He walked up to it, put his foot on it. I scooped down and did the pickup.
God.
And we walked out of the club. But what do you think we did with the money?
I have no idea. Went to another nightclub?
Probably. I mean, we were young and dumb, yeah. Right? I mean, so the point is, what we should have done, because this was over 20 years ago and $750 was a lot of money then, I should have paid a bill. Right? Because at that point...
Well, you might want to have asked the restaurant or the nightclub if anybody reported it gone.
Well, I have a feeling that the bouncer would have just pocketed the money.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm with you.
Yeah.
I would have said, I found some money. If they could give me the exact amount, I might believe them. But if they can't, they,
right.
You know, that type of thing.
Right. And I can't imagine somebody who has lost cash. Also, and again, this is in the early 2000s.
It had to be a drug dealer or somebody. Who the hell carries that around?
Right, I would assume. And it was still early enough in the night. I think it was like 10 or 11 at night. So it wasn't like it was 2 or 3 in the morning.
I wonder if somebody got arrested and dropped it because they didn't want it in their pocket or something.
Who knows?
Good Lord. the gentleman owns one of the bars in my neighborhood. He claims he spent 90% of his money on cars, women, and booze, and the other 10% he wasted.
Oh, geez.
So there's always different points of view on this, but yeah, it is pretty interesting. Matter of fact, boys, I love the fact that we're talking about clients because you're doing the same thing. There's a guy I've known for a long time, and he's a little out there, and he was going to become a client maybe 6 years ago or something. He shows me his portfolio, and I'm like, well, you know, you got a lot of concentration issues here, there. Yeah, but I love those stocks. I say, fine. Well, it ended up, he didn't come here, and you know what? Listen, I didn't want him, kind of a thing. It's nice when you reach a point where if there's just not a match, there's just not a match. So I see the guy maybe 8 weeks ago. And he says to me, hey, we should meet to talk about my account again. And I go, all right. And I said, what do you have? Well, pretty much the same stuff. And I really like these stocks. This guy says, hang on to this one, that one. And I said, well, you know, a lot of stuff has changed. And he goes, what do you mean? I said, well, not with me necessarily. I'm a little older, but not with our firm, but with you. And he goes, what are you talking about? I said, well, you just told me you're now retired. So it's not like you're making... He was doing pretty well. I said, it's not like you're making 200 grand a year. This is all you have now. It's a different world for you. He looked at me like I had three heads. I mean, I said, it's not about me. It's not about the market. It's about you. Oh, I don't know. Okay, well, I'll just keep what I have. All right, fine. You know, so let's talk about the Bears. You have changes in life that your portfolio needs to move with you a little bit. And
right.
And boy, you know, a lot of people don't, you know, it's, but if they're not open to that discussion, there's no point in even having it, really.
No, I agree. And that's one of the reasons why you have those ETFs or those mutual funds, pardon me, that are targeted for different retirement dates. So those portfolios change with you over time, and the mutual fund does it for you. So if you're looking at a retirement in 2050, they will change the asset distribution and the assets within the portfolio as you grow and mature and get closer to retirement.
Well, they used to do that with the stuff, even for the things you put in the state, things for tuition. But that all went, I won't say all, because now you're teaching it again, but that kind of went the way of the dodo bird, because it used to be as you matured, you put more in fixed income. But we've gone through a decade where fixed income was 1%. And if you put it in there, all you did was lose money, basis of inflation.
Right.
So you've totally, I would say to just about everybody, it's a big term, but who's 70 to 80 years old or older, their portfolios don't match at all what people thought a standard portfolio at that age would look like 20 years ago. Because even now, I mean, do you want to put your money in a bank? Well, we have a lot of people that since the T-bills have been 4 and 5%, we have a lot of people in T-bills.
Yeah, it's different.
But when they were 1%, I mean, how could you possibly, I mean, if you have a friend or if you had $1 million and put it in the bank in 2017 with the inflation number, that $1 million is now worth $600,000 at best, isn't it?
Right.
You could never counsel somebody to do that.
Nope, not in good faith.
Yet the same person, you can't just put them. I remember one of the guys on TV, Joe Kiernan, one day goes, the Fed is telling you that you need to put your money in the market. You can't get. I'm sitting there going, Joe, that's pretty cool for you to say. You're a TV guy. But for me, if a guy's 85 years old, how do I tell him you need to put every nickel in stock because fixed income is 1%? I can't do that. I can't change his risk curve for him like that, even though I don't want him to be anywhere at 1%. It was a tough problem.
Well, and you know, I don't think that this is true for people now. I think most people have aged out. But I keep harping back to 2008. I remember my grandma pulled all of her money out of the markets.
And before it went down or after?
After it went down. Ah, okay. So this was like in probably November of 2008 she did it. Okay? She never got back in. But this woman had lived through the Great Depression. You know, so she's, to her, as soon as something like this happens, there's such a reaction. It's, and to that behavioral finance piece, you have such an emotional connection because you've seen such horrible things. And now we've got the baby boomers who were raised by the Great Generation, who lived through the Depression, and they've seen things such as stagflation of the 70s. They've seen those oil prices. They've had issues in the early 80s where they saw the market go down. They had the beautiful 80s and 90s, and then they saw the market crash. I mean, so they've seen a lot of things happen. And I think that's one of the reasons why you have this generation who is almost flippant about what's actually happening with their asset values. Right, because their wallet will come back or it won't, and it's all paper money and it doesn't even matter. But all of these things tie into that emotional reaction to movements in the market itself.
Well, we've got such an amazing buy the dip mentality, but I've seen, you know, I've lived through two decades where we were down on the decade.
Sure.
And nobody has any idea when I say that, you know, what anybody's talking about. You know, it's if you are ever this way or whatever, and we meet, I'll drag my bro to have a cocktail with us, because he did a speech one time, and he's president of PTI, so he deals with people even more than I do. He gave a speech one time regarding just what you're talking about, somebody who like kind of sells at the bottom, and everybody else has got, you know, what are you, you know, you're like a shoe salesman, you know, you can't hang in there when you need to hang in there. And he gave a speech, and I'm sure he still has it somewhere. It was one of the most impressive things. You're never supposed to say that about your brother, right? But he said, when people say somebody has a $1 million IRA and that's all they're living on, you know, that sounds like a lot of money, but if you don't have any pension, it's really not, right? If you're living off it. And he says, if it goes to $1.5 million, everybody's happy. It runs down to $1 million and people sell. And it's back to, you know, $1.4 million 2 years later, and everybody goes, God, what an idiot you were, you sold. He says, it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with when it gets down to a number where you can no longer afford to lose any more, that's right, when you sell. It has nothing to do with an investment decision. It's a personal decision. I mean, if I put $1 million in there, went to 1.5, that's pretty cool. You know, it's better than the mill, or 1.4, and if it went back to 1.2, you're, I guess, happy with it. But once it got back down to $1 million and started to drip, you go, no, I need $1 million. I have to sell here. I don't care if it goes back up almost. I mean, I do care, but I can't take the chance. And it's an amazing thought process that nobody in the crowd even, they're all looking at him going, yeah, you're right. People sell out because they can't afford to lose anymore.
Right.
And I don't know if you've ever heard of it put quite that way.
I haven't, but it really makes sense. And especially if you're thinking about people who have lived through times such as the Great Depression or such as decades where the market hasn't outperformed and people haven't been able to eat It's amazing if you can't eat or can't afford shelter, how your viewpoint changes on your investments.
Well, that's right. And people also always look at the averages, which is very dangerous.
Right.
I mean, if you look at, I mean, now they pretty much all come back, but the stocks that were the big five in 2000 were Cisco, Oracle, Microsoft, Dell, and what was the other one? There were five. Intel. Those were the five that were, you know, 45% of the Qs, just like now. same sort of deal. Well, the market crashed in 2000, right, or 2001. It went down. The Qs were 120. They went to 25. So it was like an 80% reduction. And yes, the market has come back, but it wasn't until maybe Microsoft was $35 for a decade. Cisco still isn't. Well, maybe it is now. It's as high as it was. It's just went over where it was in 2000. Oracle, it took, even though the quote market came back, there's nothing that says your stock's going to come back.
Right.
So you can't just look at the averages, because it could be all new places. That's why I think, to a large extent, Larissa, it's one of the reasons why, I mean, at PTI, our signature program is a protected index program. I you know, trade in the OEX for 20 years. I always traded like an index anyway. So I don't have any confidence whatsoever that, and I, you know, other people think they do. For me to pick out 10 stocks for you that I know are still going to be percolating along and leading their industry 10 years from now, guess what? I don't know anybody that can do that. You can pick the ones. We had a thing on the show once about pick stocks 10 years from now that you think are still going to be leading stocks. And we had some people zeroed in on, like, you know, toilet paper and soap manufacturers, figured they're still going to be. Other people zeroed in on defense stocks. But, I mean, it's pretty hard to do that. So that's why we do index stuff. Because, I mean, if the S&P drops 50%, guess what? They're going to lob all the stocks out of it. There's always going to be an S&P. PTI could be in the S&P, right? They'll find 500 stocks that have value. That doesn't mean your stuff's going up, does it? I mean, it is, I would love to, I think your class has to be absolutely fascinating, because I bet you could teach it 5 days a week and never touch the same subject.
Well, sometimes I can. Sometimes it might be a little more challenging of a day, and it's nice to recycle material.
What? So, how many? You're teaching three classes or two?
Three classes.
And night and day, or just day?
Just day.
What's? I bet it sounds like you really like the new place.
Oh, I love Purdue. I have nothing but the best things to say about Purdue, and I really enjoy my students.
How did they contact you? You can, not that it's probably none of my business, but you made the switch. You also liked Indiana,
and I did like Indiana.
So how did somebody convince you that as much as you like the one place, you'd like this maybe even more?
I had some personal reasons for wanting to make the switch, but I really enjoyed both Indiana. I loved my colleagues at Indiana. I have nothing but the best things to say about Kelly. And Purdue, one of the things that I like particularly about the program that I'm teaching in, so I'm in the FCPL, Financial Counseling Planning Program, which is housed under Hospitality Tourism Management, which is housed under the College of Human Sciences.
Really? Okay.
My classes are a lot smaller, so I know my students very well. And so yesterday we were doing a review in investments, and some of my students had quizzical looks on their faces, and I was able to call them out by name and say, you, what's your question about this? And it's a small enough environment where the student actually feels comfortable enough to say, well, I don't understand what you meant by this. And that's a very enjoyable atmosphere for me.
So you get some head bobbers, as we used to call them.
I do.
For those that don't know what that means, I'd be giving a lecture on options, just like Russ is giving a lecture. And Does everybody understand what I'm talking about? And everybody starts shaking their head, and my brother goes, hey, they're just head bopping. They have no idea what you just said.
Yeah, no idea.
So you get a chance to say, what did I really say? And a kid probably looks like he shot him, right, when you ask him that?
Right, exactly.
Are most of these guys and ladies, are they engineering students that just do this stuff on the side, or is this a major, what you're doing?
This is a major.
Okay.
So for the CFP, you have to go through a accredited program, and then as an institution, we verify that they have taken enough hours so that they can sit for the CFP exam.
Okay. Well, good for you. One of these days, hopefully I'll meet you again. She and Russell came into the office one day, and let's put it this way. She's as charming in person as she is on the radio. That's all I'll say. And you were with Russell.
Thank you, Bert.
And well, hopefully we'll see you. And by the way, I hope he's back next week, but I like you both on. I like either one on. So I'm either way, it's always a good day for me. So thank you very much. SP Futures now only up 10. NASDAQ Futures up 66. Again, the big number tonight is NVIDIA. It's not just the number, is what the chairman's going to say, and he's really good at that. I got to straddle at about, I think it's like 12, 13 bucks. Stock's trading 184. So it's not, they're not predicting that big of a move. The market isn't. But we'll talk all about it tomorrow morning. Thanks again, Andrew. Nice job. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.